Well, that works. All right. I think I'm going to have to tap, unless somebody else knows. I tried both of them. Technology is great when it works. If not, I can just go up there. There it goes. Thanks very much. Seems to be. Yeah, thanks very much. So I just put this up here to let you see right in front of you where we're headed. We're covering chapters 1 to 4. We'll get through the end of chapter 4 today. And then each week, I'd like you, or each class, I'd like you to read the chapters that are there in parentheses beforehand, twice, it says on the assignment sheet. Read it through twice. And then take notes. Take notes of questions you have, observations that are really interesting to you, things you want to stump me with, because there's a lot of that in there. Whatever. And bring that preparation to class. That's all I ask. So make sure you have a schedule. I want to start this evening by, if you read the first four chapters, reviewing relationships. Some of you may be familiar with everything I'm going to show here. But many of you may not be. It helped me to just kind of draw it out. Okay, all these names that I'm introduced to or that are being thrown around just in the first four chapters, how do I keep them straight? The relationships, who are family members, who reports to who, that type of thing. We all know Saul. You know, really starting from about chapter 20 of 1 Samuel, Saul was in pursuit of David, who had been anointed king by God. Saul didn't relinquish his kingship. Pursued David, persecuted him, and at the end of 1 Samuel dies. Saul had sons. One son in particular, there's a fair bit of 1 Samuel refers to him. What's his name? Jonathan. Jonathan, we're going to talk, in fact, several of these names we're going to talk about in detail tonight. But Jonathan is a son of Saul who becomes very close friends with David, very loyal to David. In chapter 4 of 2 Samuel, we're told that Jonathan had a son. What was Jonathan's son's name mentioned there? All right. Mephibosheth is Jonathan's son. And you think about what is said about him there. There will be more referred to him later on in 2 Samuel. But Mephibosheth, when Saul and Jonathan are killed in battle against the Philistines, the nurse that is taking care of five-year-old Mephibosheth hears that Israel has been defeated, may have heard that Saul and Jonathan have died, I might say that, and she attempts to flee with young Mephibosheth, and he falls during that fast pursuit and becomes lame due to that. So we'll see him later, but he is Jonathan's son. There's another son of Saul that is prominent, sort of, in chapters 1 to 4. What is his name? Right, you can see him in chapter 2, I think about verse 8. His name is Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is another son of Saul, a brother to Jonathan. Jonathan is dead at the start of 2 Samuel. Ishbosheth wrongly assumes the throne in chapter 2, and we'll see more about him. The person who helps him ascend to the throne was the commander of Saul's army. What was his name? Right, Abner. I'm going to place him there. I don't know if that's the best way to show it, but Abner is there because he reports to Saul, or did report to Saul, as the commander of his army. In fact, I'm going to put a little shield right there. He's the military fellow. And he promotes Ishbosheth up to king in chapter 2. Also, I'm going to go ahead and put on the chart here Rechab and Baana, who are described as troops under Ishbosheth. So they would have reported to Abner, and they do something terrible in chapter 4. So they're a part of the army. And I've got that red line there to say Abner and Rechab and Baana would have been a part of Saul's kingdom, but then lifted up Ishbosheth and sided with him in chapter 2. But then there's David. We all know David. David's father's name was Jesse. Okay, David had siblings. He had brothers, right? David was which in the line of brothers? He was the youngest, right? David had sisters, too. In fact, if you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 2, I think it's verse 13 or verse 16, two of his sisters are referred to there. and one of them named Zeruiah. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Zeruiah. She is a sister to David. Zeruiah, in that same verse, let me make sure I get the reference right, chapter 2 and verse 16 of 1 Chronicles, we're told there she had three sons. And those three sons, if you did the reading, are familiar to you. They are Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. All right? So these are the names that pop up primarily in 2 Samuel chapters 1 to 4. And we are going to refer to and talk about the character of all these that I've highlighted in green here. They are prominent in the text. So we'll bring this chart up several times through the class tonight. Hopefully it helps to see how they're all related. Before we get into 2 Samuel directly, though, I do have a little bit more of a recap that I want to go through because it bleeds again right into 2 Samuel chapter 1. I really kind of skimmed on Sunday over 1 Samuel chapters 26 to 31, and I think it's important to kind of quickly digest what was going on in those chapters. Chapter 26 I did refer to in detail. That was the second time that David had a chance to kill Saul. If you go to that chapter and just kind of skim through it, actually I'm going to read a little bit of it, 1 Samuel 26, so maybe flip back there. David and his men come upon Saul and his army, and Saul and his army are asleep, all gathered together. And it says in a verse in this chapter that God had caused a deep sleep to come upon them. Well, David recognizes the opportunity there, and not just David, but Abishai, who is one of those three brothers of David's sister. Abishai is there with him and has gone down to the camp. And it says in verse 7 that David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp with his spear stuck in the ground by his head. And there's Abner. Abner and all the people lay around him. So it's Saul and his army, his biggest military commander, is there asleep as well. And verse 8 says that Abishai said to David, "God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time." David, in chapter 24, we saw, just cut off a piece of Saul's robe when he had that first chance. And how did he feel after he did that? "This is not right. I ought not lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed and do such a thing." Now back then, he kind of took an action and then felt bad about it afterward. Since then, he's had that incident with Abigail. Mercy's been shown to him. And in this moment, he shows no hesitation. It says, verse 9, "But David said to Abishai, 'Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?'" Right? His response is more resolute. He trusts the Lord is going to handle it in his own time. He has his experience with Nabal to back it up. Verse 10 is interesting. "David said, furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed." You see his attitude. He trusts that God's going to take care of things in his own time with his anointed. He's not going to presume, right? So, and he has to stop Abishai in doing this. I really want to highlight that because we're going to see Abishai later. While David spares Saul, they take the jug and the spear, they run to a safe place, and they call out and wake people up. But Saul is not the first person addressed. Look a couple of verses down, and who is the first person that David identifies by name when he calls out and wakes everybody up? Abner is, not Saul. What does he say to Abner? Verse 14, David called out to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, "Do you not answer Abner?" And I kind of picture Abner as like, you know, rubbing his eyes but quickly jumping up and trying to get his bearings, right? And he gets up, and Abner said, "Who are you calling out to the king?" And David said, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die." Why does he say that David deserves to die? Look at the end of that verse where I stopped reading. Was it because Saul was an evil man and Abner was serving him? What was the reason David gave? What's that? He didn't guard God's anointed. What does that say about David? I'm going to ask that question a lot, because I think the book is intended to make us think about David and David's spirit and his thought patterns. And it doesn't just come right out and say, you know, here's the easy way to characterize David and his thinking. It makes you see him in experiences and how he weighs and judges things. And again and again and again, you're going to see David's whole experience when he's got things going right is looking at everything through the eyes of the Lord. His life, his role, his responsibilities, other people's responsibilities, all through the eyes of the Lord. Sure, and we're going to see a lot of that. Yeah, absolutely. So he calls out Abner for not protecting the Lord's anointed. Really interesting. David spares Saul here, and as you read the end of chapter 26, his appeal to trusting the Lord is very strong. Chapter 27, though, shows him discouraged once again. And what he ends up doing is going off and joining the Philistines. Serving under Achish, the Philistine, during that time. And it seems to me, my judgment is, at that point in time, he's just not sure what the will of the Lord is. He's struggling with that a lot. While he's under Achish, he's covertly attacking the enemies of God, which shows some spirit of service to God. But at the same time, it's not a good situation, particularly when chapter 28 comes up. At the beginning of that chapter, David has served so well, Achish believes, that he calls on David to join the great attack on Israel. All right, you're David. How do you respond to that? I mean, okay. I imagine him not saying much, but wondering how to excise himself out of the situation. Right around verse 3, when you're wondering, what is David going to do? What is going to happen? It's like the camera turns. Woo, you know, it's a narrative. And now we're looking at Saul. What does Saul do throughout chapter 28? You might have a heading there that describes it. That's right. That's right. At this point in time, he, with all that he has done, God is not responding to any call of his. It says that he's receiving no word from the Lord. And you just, the picture is of sadness. Because you see where all of this life is led, and he seeks out a medium, a witch, to sort of tell what next. It did. It was against God's law. Mm-hmm. Right. Saul, we just see his crash. And it's a tragedy, spiritually and physically. So by the time you get to the end of chapter 28, it's just sad. And the pronouncement is given that God has judged him and he will die in battle. Well, in chapter 29, the camera zips back and there's David. Ah, what's about to happen to him? And chapter 29, I believe, shows God providentially releasing David from having to fight against Israel. He's told to go home by the princes of the Philistines, which means go back to the city of Philistia that he was living in. So he does that. In chapter 30, when he gets back, though, the city has been destroyed. By who? Amalekites. Why is that shocking? The Amalekites were supposed to have all been destroyed back in chapter 15 by Saul, but they're not. They have destroyed the city of Ziklag. They've killed many people, taken away many people, and among those are people that are personally important to David and his men, wives, children, so forth. And when they get there, his men, everybody cry out. In fact, they are so stricken with disappointment at the sadness that they are ready to stone David, to put him to death. At which point, David says what? It would have been very easy for him to just think, this is rock bottom. There's nothing more for me here. But it says what he did was bring the ephod. We're going to talk to God. And he inquires of God, what do I do? God says, go out against the Amalekites. And through God's power, it is obvious through this, God brings victory to David over the Amalekites. They rescue everyone. They bring back many spoils. And David, we're meant to see, realizes that God is merciful, that God is faithful, that even though he was undeserving, God has given him an escape from a situation that could have completely destroyed him. So it's with that mindset that I think we're supposed to enter the book of 1 Samuel. Chapter 31, I read, and it almost reads like a slow-mo camera shot in a movie that's showing a battle scene that is just falling apart. And Saul and his sons, it says, die. The Philistines take the body of Saul and desecrate it. The last thing that we're told in chapter 31 is that the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who back in chapter 11, Saul rescued them from a threat during his faithful time. The men of Jabesh-Gilead go and rescue the body of Saul to honor him. As we enter into chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, let's talk first about the Amalekite and what happens here. That Amalekite, it says that it's a couple of days after that battle. You know, David was off attacking the Amalekites in Ziklag, and he didn't know everything that had happened in that battle where the Philistines were doing their major attack on the Israelites. The Amalekite comes and has a report. What did he look like, this Amalekite, when he arrived? Yep. Okay, so everything about his appearance looked like he's had a rough time. Tough way to get over to David. What did he claim to have seen and done? In a nutshell. Right. It says, I saw Saul. He was nearing unto death, and he basically said, I need you to kill me and put me out of my misery. And so I did so, and I took his crown, and I took his armband, and all of this, and I brought it to you, David. It says, where is it? So I stood over him and killed him, verse 10, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. I took the crown that was on his head and bracelet that was on his arm and brought them here to my Lord. Was his report true? Yeah, so how do you know that? What does it say in chapter 31? In 1 Samuel chapter 31, it does report that Saul fell on his sword. And it says his armor bearer, when he saw Saul dead, did the very same thing, right? There are the report of the Amalekite is questionable. There have been some that have said, well, maybe his report somehow aligns and is true relative to chapter 31. I personally don't see that. I think he is reporting something that is false. And I believe that in part because David understood what his motive was in coming. Chapter 4. If you look over in chapter 4, in verse 10, when David's about to address a different situation, he says, when someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news. Now, do you notice that? The Amalekite, David understood, was coming to him with what the Amalekite thought was good news. Why would the Amalekite think that was good news? To share with David that Saul was dead. Since chapter 20, for years, Saul has been chasing David, pursuing him. Everyone knew that, right? But not only that, he thought to bring good news. Well, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag, the one who I thought would give him a reward for his good news. That's the way David saw the situation. He saw that here's a fellow thinking, you know, I'm going to get something out of this. Now, you know, even if you want to argue the question of whether or not his story was true, let's just stop and take back, you know, what that says in chapter 4, verse 10. The Amalekite was not interested in anything but himself, right? How would you summarize the Amalekite's character? I don't want to say too much. Okay. Okay. That who should have been dead? Okay. The Amalekite knew that he should have been dead. Okay, there is something I wonder about that. Most of his people have been wiped out. Where is his mindset? You know, I'm not sure, but he's not afraid to go to David, which is really interesting to me. I think the Amalekites would understand that their history is such that God had pronounced judgment against them. The Amalekites had done what? Attacked Israel as they were leaving as slaves, being released by God out into and through the Red Sea and into the wilderness. They attacked them there, and because of that, God pronounced judgment on them. So his lack of fear is interesting toward David. David also said he should fear who? The Amalekites should have feared who? Look down in chapter 1. Well, sorry, your answer is correct, actually. Verse 14. David said to him, "How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" That's an interesting thing that David says. And it, you know, well, how much did the Amalekite understand? David seems to suggest the Amalekite should have known, you ought not to have reached out your hand, said anything like this about the one that God had set over Israel. Seems that he would have understood that proper relationship. The Amalekites should have understood, seeing the history of Israel all the way back from the beginning, coming out of Egypt, and now they're established in the land. They have a king in the land, right? Clearly they have been blessed. But David says, you should have had fear, but you didn't. Interestingly, the Amalekite, if you say that, as I think, that he didn't really do this, it's really interesting to think that what does David do to him? Executes him, right? Which is, was that right of David? Was that God's will concerning the Amalekites? Yeah, I believe so. But if it's true that he has given this deception, then he was put to death in a sense for something he didn't really do. Yet at the same time, this is just me, I can't help but think of the scriptures like in 1 John chapter 3, where God equates hatred, you know, that idea of doing what is wrong to your brother as murder. It is clear that in the spirit of the Amalekite is nothing but what can I get out of this, not what has happened to the fallen king of Israel. I want my reward, right? That's the Amalekite's character. What's David's character? How does David respond to the news about Saul and Jonathan? Okay, I'm going to keep track on this slide of the things that we see in David. Right? If that Amalekite has come thinking David's going to be glad to hear this, he's going to be shocked when David spends the whole day tearing his clothes, mourning, weeping, fasting, not only for himself, but all his men with him. I mean, I just imagine that Amalekite all day, like, okay. Next for me? Well, what's next for him is the execution of the Amalekite. David again is seeing through the eyes of God what God's will is, and in this, with this Amalekite, this is what God wanted him to do. So David, again, why would he mourn, weep, fast until evening when told of this news? Why wasn't it good news to him? Okay. Okay, in these next verses, we have David writing a lament about what has happened. Writing a lament about what has happened. I thought that was mine. And in that lament, where he's purposely put words together to give honor, to show sadness at things, you see his view of Israel and his sadness over the glory that has fallen. You see his sadness over Saul, who is mentioned specifically in what we see as kind of glowing terms, and particularly of Jonathan, right? It's clear that David is concerned in the song about the personal relationships, but also about how low Israel has sunk and how that reflects on God. So in this lament, which is very interesting, I'd love to take time to like dig into it and look deeply, but I don't have the time to do that. What are some of the main themes? How the mighty have fallen is a phrase that comes up a few times. The fallen glory is there. But I really want to notice the references to Saul and Jonathan. you know, he does speak of Saul in a respectful, honorable light. And maybe that is reflective of him remembering there were good things about Saul at times. And maybe it's reflective of that honor that he's always going to give to the anointed of God. Whatever it is, it's amazing to me, given all that has happened in these years, that he can speak in this way. But then there's some space at the end reserved particularly for Jonathan. Verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. Tell me what you know about Jonathan. Truly loved David, loyal to David. Okay, Jonathan was the son of Saul. It's implied that he's clearly in the normal way of thinking, from the human way of thinking, that he would be the one in line to assume the kingship after Saul. And yet, and I'm pointing out where Jonathan is once again on the slide, you see him there in green, you know, and yet when you see him in 1 Samuel, when David has returned, young David, from the defeat of Goliath, immediately, chapter 18, verses 1 to 4, Jonathan makes a covenant with David. And there's this scene where he gives his robe, his armor, his sword, his belt, his bow over to David. I think signifying, David, you are the next king, not me. What does that say about Jonathan and his faith and respect for David? Chapter 19, Jonathan protects David. Saul in his jealousy is already trying to kill him, kill David. And Jonathan holds his father Saul to account for his murderous intentions, even reasons with Saul at that time, and Saul realizes David has done no wrong, and he stops for a time. 1 Samuel 20 is a chapter that's entirely devoted to Jonathan helping David in his final flight away from the city. And in that chapter, Jonathan makes a covenant with David that's really powerful. I just want to read a couple of words from that. Verse 12 of 1 Samuel 20, Jonathan said to David, "The Lord of God of Israel is witness. When I've sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there's a good toward David, I do not send to you and tell you, well, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away that you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live," this is Jonathan talking, "you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Just in verses 12 through 17, you get that impression that Jonathan sees through the same lens that David does, right? It's not about me and what I think. It's not about my dad and what he thinks. It's not about the nation around me and what they think should happen. How does the Lord see things? What is his will in things? And Jonathan's willing to lay down any claim he might have to position or anything else because of his love for the Lord and because of his love for David. And I think he finds in David love because of David's love for the Lord. Right? In chapter 23, Jonathan, Saul is like hunting for David and having such a hard time doing it, can't find him. It says Jonathan walked in the woods and there was David, and they had a conversation and they renewed a covenant. And it says in chapter 23, get those words, verse 17, that Jonathan said to David, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." You know, you think about David in that phrase, "Your love surpasses the love of women. How pleasant you are." People have said, people have presumed very wrong things about what that statement means. And that might be in part because people can't imagine what the best kind of love is. Think about what is being described here between these two. David valued a love that, like him, saw the world only through the lens of the eyes of the Lord. Didn't matter what it meant for him. Selfish ambition didn't matter. Only that the Lord's will is done. And as I was thinking about these verses, it challenged me to ask the question, well, you know, think about my friends. Think about your friends. Do you have friends that are loyal, not just to you, but are loyal to you because of the Lord and because they love you and the Lord, to the point where they want to work with you and beside you and together with you to accomplish the Lord's will? I mean, the kind of relationship that is here, that is rooted in nothing but love of the Lord and one another, that's the kind of love that surpasses the love of women. That's David's point. That is the greatest love. Greater love has no man than what? Than to lay down his life for his friends. Whether that be, I'll take a bullet for you, or whether that be, I'll lay down all my selfish desires to serve you and the Lord. I want friends like that. You do too. So it's pretty powerful to see Jonathan here in his in the statement that David makes of him. So the song of the bow. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 4, David immediately, his first step is to say, God, what next? Which is wonderful. Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah? You shall. And so David goes. And he becomes king. But not of all the people of Israel. He becomes king of Judah at this point in time. The rest of Israel is not willing to serve. And it's interesting, I don't see David complaining or whining or pitching a fit. There's almost some sense that he gathers, well, if it's not the Lord's time to make me king over all, then I'm going to wait for that time, in the time of the Lord. He blesses Jabesh Gilead and their honoring of Saul here, which, once again, we keep asking the question, how is that different than what normal people would do? Like, I might immediately have the most suspicion of the men of Jabesh Gilead if I thought like the typical human political person would think. David blesses them for their willingness to risk their lives for the honoring of the Lord's anointed. And then we come to Abner, who's introduced to us in chapter 2. He's the commander of Saul's army. Now he's going to take, in verse 8, Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. He's going to bring him over to the east side of the Jordan River, and he is going to make him king. I want to remind you what is said back in 1 Samuel chapter 26. Remember when David and Abishai call out and wake all the army up. You know, when David's calling to Abner, he says, who is like you in Israel? What does that tell you about how Abner was perceived among the people of Israel? He is a leader, powerful guy. He's the man, right? I mean, he's got a reputation for being a tough cookie, right? He's clearly, you see that in how he sort of behaves. He makes Ishbosheth king over Israel, and from this point, it's very clear that he's the one that's really holding the reins. We'll talk about Ishbosheth in a minute. And yet, it's really interesting, in chapter 3, verses 9 and 18, he apparently knows, and you can see this back in 1 Samuel as well, Saul knew, Abigail knew, Abner knew, everybody knew that God had appointed David to become the next king. Abner knew this, and yet he set up Ishbosheth. What would motivate somebody to do that? Any of a number of reasons that are all selfish and all... How easy... Have you done that before, where you know something is true about God and yet you act contrary to his purposes anyway? That's Abner doing. And he, in chapter 2, you know, he's lifted Ishbosheth up, and... and all the people not of Judah, basically, are following after him. He apparently, in chapter 2, brings a force of some kind over to the west side of the river near Hebron, where David is hanging out, Hebron being down there on the bottom left. And there's a contest of a sort. He says to Joab, who will be identified later as the commander of David's army, he says to Joab, let's have the young men fight. Let's let them compete. Some translations say, let's have a contest. Why? I'm not 100% sure because the text doesn't say. I don't know if they thought that they could sort of, you know, duke it out and calm military tensions this way. If so, that didn't work, because what happens? Like the whole war blows up, you know, right after this. If they thought that somehow, because I've heard it explained before that in David versus Goliath in that battle of champions while all the armies are kind of watching, I've heard it said before that that can be explained in part. There's some evidence that supports the idea that it was believed that God or the gods would be behind the sides that were fighting. And so whichever side won, it was a sign of the choice of God or the gods. In this case, I don't know, is Joab and Abner, are they thinking, well, God's will be shown if we have this fighting match? Whatever happens, it blows up on them. What does it mean? That's right. And where did the battle end up going? Yeah, that came to, I mean, really, Abner's side was defeated more soundly, but in the end, they kind of call it all off at the end of the evening. And yeah, when you get to the end of the chapter, it's God's will is not apparent in the things that have happened in this chapter. Yeah, good. But in terms of the two sides trying to determine the winner militarily without the direction of God, that was not the way to go at it. But you're right, maybe the Lord's will is done in that the thing ended the way his will was done, in that it was ended the way that it was. Finally, oh, I skipped on already, didn't I? He was in chapter 3, Ishbosheth, who he's kind of lifted up, accuses him of going into one of his father's concubines, which he denies vehemently. Now, if he did, it was a sign that he was, you know, that would have been a sign that he was trying to take some power for himself. It doesn't say that he ever actually did that. In fact, his reaction is almost like, you're accusing me of this, and I have been as loyal to you as I have been, and I have not turned you into David. And I, out of his response there in chapter 3, you get the sense that what Abner valued was military strength. He valued loyalty in the ranks. He valued, you know, these are things that men value, but are they the most important things to God? Not if the leader or the ranks are against God's will, right? And so he ends up essentially defecting, it would seem, and going over to David's side and saying, I will make a covenant with you. I know that God has appointed you. I don't know where Abner was in his thought process. It would seem, though, he was taking some kind of step towards the right action. Ultimately, Joab is bothered by all of this and doesn't believe it. In fact, he says to David, I can't believe you're having this conversation. He's just spying you out. And Joab kills him. David, come back to his attitude here, did something that I think a lot of political leaders wouldn't have done. I think he extended trust. And that trust was extended to Abner, yes, but ultimately, where does David's trust really reside? It's in God. David probably didn't know how all this was going to shake out. Probably thought, wow, this is a turn of events. He uses it as an opportunity in chapter 3 and verse 13. He says, I will make a covenant with you, Abner, but one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter. Why did he care about her? She was his wife. Saul had taken her away, and they had been separated in all this time that he was. She had even married another, right? He says, "I want Michal here," which I believe is a sign that he respected, you know, that marriage, and that he wanted things to be as proper as they needed to be there. So he extends some trust. Yes. True. So there's some political benefit here, which I'm glad you made that point, because several things that David does here can be interpreted through the eyes of David's being really politically wise, very politically astute. And I can't deny that. I think that's a part of the dynamic here. And yet, I don't think we're meant to see David, you know, if the only lesson that's coming across to us is David was more politically wise than anybody else. We're missing a huge dimension, I think, to his trust in God. But that's a really great point. Joab, what are your impressions of Joab? Loyal to David. So, yeah, a little rash. So he's the suspicious one. I mean, in my mind, he's almost like the model of, well, here's how I would expect David to respond, right? I don't trust you. And yet, David extends quite a bit more trust in this, right? Yes. Yeah, so I kind of skipped over that aspect, right? Because in chapter 2, Asahel is killed by Abner. And so Asahel is Joab's brother, and Joab's sadness and a sense of revenge potentially could have led to this, all of which are spirits that are really dangerous for him. And unbeknownst to David, he calls Abner back. Abner probably thinks, hey, everything's going pretty good here, coming back to dad. Joab wants to meet with me, and then secretly is killed. Yes. 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 Right. Well, all of which raises that again, you know, what is the model being set for us? There's David and there's Joab and there's Abner and all of these. Let me talk about Ishbosheth. We won't finish everything, but we'll get most of it. Ishbosheth is interesting. The way I read it, there's basically four things recorded about him after he became king. First one is that he accused Abner of going into David's concubine, in which case you see Abner responding, hey, you know, you're not being loyal to me. I could have turned you in. Basically, I could have destroyed you. Who's really in power here? Abner. He sent Michal to David. The contingency was there. Send me Michal. Ishbosheth sends the husband of Michal that she is married, is all sad about it, coming with her. Who turns that husband back? Abner, not Ishbosheth. Once again, there's Abner with the strength. Chapter 4, verse 1, when he sees that Abner has been killed, it says that he lost heart. All three of these things point to Abner as being the real pusher here. Fourth thing that is said about him is he laid on a bed at noon. That is the sum of Ishbosheth's life, right? What do you think of that? What are your impressions of Ishbosheth and what is said about him? He was weak. I mean, I see in Joab and Abner this, I'm going to take control and do things, you know, the way that ought to be done. I'm going to be suspicious. I'm going to take revenge. I see Ishbosheth, not that he didn't have any of these. There's very little told to us. He's got more of a life than these four things, I'm sure. But kind of the way that he's pictured here is as somebody that's being pushed along in a lot of ways. And it makes me think, well, how many times do we get pushed along by the Joabs and the Abners of the world, instead of looking to the models of David and Jonathan and our Lord as the ones to follow? From the beginning, Ishbosheth, he knew David should be king. So we will stop there and finish the Rechab and Baana next time. We're almost to the end. But read chapters 5 and 6.